Hello, it's Wednesday, July the 7th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, you might have thought it was a phenomenon just from the 1980s, but gazumping, it's back, and in a very big way. Universities, they're being warned if they fail students by doing online teaching, they could face huge fines. It's all about football. Come on, England. Is football finally coming home? But first, isolation insanity. We're going to cap into keep isolate for another month if we get pinged by test and trace, even though that could have another huge effect on the economy. So self-isolation rules are to continue for another 6 weeks and have sparked a furious reaction, not least from the hospitality industry, which has had a terrible time in the pandemic. From August 16th only, workers will be exempt from 10 days of isolation, but only if they're double vaccinated and take daily tests, if they're pinged by the Test and Trace app. Charlie Jilks is the founder of the Inception Group, and he's the owner of 11 London venues, and he joins me now. Charlie, so much for Freedom Day. It's not really Freedom Day, is it, on July the 19th, if we've still got these ludicrous self-isolation rules in place until the middle of August? Very difficult for your organisation, I would have thought.
Andrew, it's honestly, you couldn't have put it better. It is an absolute nightmare. You know, they're saying this is going to be sort of the great reopening on the 19th, but I'll be amazed if many places are open. We've, you know, got 11 sites. Three had to shut completely last week because we did not have enough staff to be able to operate them. You know, people are getting pinged by the track and trace app, left, right, and centre. And, you know, if we were to look statistically and say that three were shut this week, if cases quadruple, then every one of my sites would be in lockdown, you know, by August. And I have no idea why this has been delayed. It's just defies logic. Why can you come back and quarantine and after 5 days have an early test to release scheme? Why is that not an option if you're in isolation domestically? And why have you been double jabbed? Can he not now be released early? What's going to change mid-August? And also, surely, logically, if members of staff have had COVID in the last couple of months, they are going to be immune for at least six. So surely they shouldn't have to isolate. The rules make absolutely no sense at all. And this is going to, you know, bring the economy to an absolute standstill. Hospitality workers, retail workers, we can't work from home. They've got to be
no.
there.
Of course. The danger for the government will be that people will just think, to hell with it, and they'll just ignore the test and trace. They'll get the ping and they'll ignore it. They'll just carry on going to work. And that potentially could be a problem because maybe they've got COVID.
Exactly. You know, there needs to be a more logical test release scheme, which is being used very effectively in America. You know, we are actually, you know, carrying on testing all of our staff every day before a shift at the moment. You know, which works well, and you can catch cases. But you know, people are doing it at home before they come to work. There needs to be more logic applied to this. You know, I don't think really that they've thought through if there are 100,000 cases a day, that's
yeah,
close
quite.
To a million people a week with COVID, and then if you put, you know, put that sort of context, you know, that's going to be millions a week.
They're talking of 3.5. They're talking of 3.5 million a week, Charlie. So that, if you think, then in 6 weeks, that's nearly 20 million people could be isolating at home. Which means not only will you have no staff for your venues, there'll be nobody going to them either because they'll all be at home as well. Your potential customers.
No, exactly. And you know, the great worry for us is, you know, over 65% of hospitality's workforce are under 25.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're really pushing our staff and encouraging our staff as much as possible to have their jabs. And I'm happy to say most have had a first jab. But, you know, with this 8 weeks sort of wait between the first and second jab, they're not likely to get the second one until sort of end of August, beginning of September. That's a sort of a write-off of a summer. And, you know, I really think the government need to rethink this. They haven't thought this through and there are big unintended consequences.
Just fine, Charlie. I mean, you've had a shocker of a year, 15 months. Just when you think you can start getting back to normal, this is another hammer blow, isn't it?
It really is. I described it to someone the other day. It's like playing a game of snakes and ladders. You know, you go, the restrictions are eased, you go up a ladder, you move to places, and then only to slide down an enormous snake again. It's really difficult. Look, I'm trying to be upbeat and positive. I think the demand is there. People are wanting to come back. The times we can trade, we've traded ahead of expectations. You know, I think there's a bright future for the hospitality sector. But we've got to have a government that thinks through these things, because, you know, the economy can't recover, you know, with these track and trace rules. You know, we're going to be in an effective lockdown with none of the support.
Well, Charlie, best of luck. We're banging on at the government too. The Daily Mail is campaigning against this because we think it's absolutely... we called it insanity on our front page today, and it is insanity. So best of luck. Let's hope they see the light and realism takes over. That's Charlie Jilks. He's the founder of Inception Group. Thanks for joining us. Why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at mailplus or me at toryboypierce. So it was announced yesterday that universities who only offer online classes could face investigation for providing inadequate teaching. The higher education regulator, the Office for Students, OFS, is monitoring the quality of teaching at universities amid record levels of dissatisfaction among students who continue to pay full fees despite often being forced to learn remotely during most of the pandemic. I'm joined now by Nick Hillman. He's director of the Higher Education Policy Institute. Nick, we saw only this week Manchester University announcing to its students that they will be taught online and there will be no reduction in their fees, which struck me as being, frankly, outrageous.
Well, it's difficult for me to go into the details of Manchester because I actually happen to be a governor there. But
oh dear, that's very tricky then. Yeah.
Point, yeah. But the general point is a really difficult one here, in that universities are in a bit of a catch-22 situation. So this time last year, they were saying life would be back to normal in September 2020 and everything would be face-to-face.
Sure.
And it turned out that wasn't possible to do. And so universities don't want to promise things that might not prove to be possible this September. But it's not just that. I mean, it's not just that. Some of the educational technologies that have been rolled out are popular among students and particular groups of students. So disabled students, for example, find a lot of the online provision better than some of the face-to-face stuff. But you're right. I mean, look, we ourselves published a survey about 10 days ago showing students' perceptions of value for money of their from their courses is worse than ever before. And where students are getting really bad provision, I mean, I would, you know, even though universities pay my salary, I would urge them to complain and make sure they're getting what they've been promised.
And what of also, Nick, that the idea that university, it's not just about learning, it's about the social experience. It's about the interaction with other students living in a hall of residence or in digs and the interaction with the lecturers. That's all part of the degree.
That's 100% right. So our research shows that actually, even though lectures are not always a very effective way to learn, what students like about them is meeting their friends, meeting people from, you know, other cultures, other countries, other, you know, other parts of the UK. And it's part attending a lecture. The learning environment is part of a student's social life. And that's gone, as well as all the nightclubbing and, you know, going out to the bar and all the rest of it. So you're absolutely right. This is not just a conversation about teaching and learning. It's a conversation about the wider student experience. And that is the thing, if anything, the students are missing most of all. It's those opportunities to socialise.
And I saw that petition signed by 4,000 students. It said if we wanted an online degree, we'd have paid a third of the price to go to the Open University. They've got a point, haven't they?
Well, they have a up to a point, yes. I think they do. None of the universities that I have come across are saying everything will be online. They're saying some of the really big lectures will be online. The seminars will happen. But look, students who really don't want that will vote with their feet and go somewhere else. You know, they apply through UCAS. They make lots of different options. No one is forced to go anywhere. And I would urge students to do their homework before they go. It's not too late even now to change your decision about where you're going. And if you don't want to go somewhere for these sorts of reasons, you know, the world is your oyster. Universities want to recruit students. I mean, the other thing I would say is that, of course, although life is tough for students at the moment, life for non-students is also tough. So young people who choose not to go to university are finding it tougher than ever to get a job. Their social lives are disrupted too. And the people who are going to university and working their way through
their degree, even in the midst of a pandemic, will be very well served afterwards, because they'll prove they've got resilience. Employers want to recruit graduates more than they want to recruit non-graduates. So I would urge students who can to stick with it. But also, if they're unhappy, literally to complain to their university. They'll find their university has a complaints procedure. And if they're really unhappy, if they've been promised things that have not happened, they should use it.
Very interesting advice. Thanks for that. That's Nick Kilman. He's director of the Higher Education Policy Institute. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Daily Mail columnist Belle Mooney has said she's never liked football until now, and she joins me to talk about her new love of the sport. What happened, Belle? How did you see the light?
Well, I have to say, it's really about my patriotism. You know, I love this country. I'm proud of this country. And I'm quite enamored of the flag of St. George, our flag, our English flag. So it starts from there. I think that, you know, I wanted to get behind our team, our boys. But that was only the lead in, because then I started to see how good they are. And I started to appreciate technique and flair and, you know, understand what was going on. So last night I watched Spain and Italy.
You really are
England
converted.
Wasn't playing.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, I was thinking, my God, that's good. Aren't they good? Look at the poetry of it. Oh my God, for the first time in my life, I can see that it's a beautiful game.
Do you even understand the offside rule? Because I certainly don't.
No, look, I don't. I say to my husband, he's not a sports fan. I said, are they not allowed to shoot from there? I don't know. I've always liked rugby. I used to watch my boyfriend when I was in the sixth form. I used to watch my boyfriend play rugby every home game at the boys' grammar school, you know. And I did understand rugby much more. But I'm getting to understand football.
Absolutely.
And I think we've got a great team. And I just love them all. I feel very motherly towards them. Is that ridiculous?
No, it's not, because, look, I don't care about football, but I've got swept along on this wave too. But I love your description of some of our players. So, Belle Mooney, Harry Kane, straight from the fields of Agincourt, with the air of a medieval knight, a strong jaw and noble forehead.
Yes, I get a bit flowery, don't I? That's good.
I think it's fabulous.
But it's true, isn't it? You know, and then you read the backstories. As I said in this morning's piece, I started to read our sports pages. I mean, we've got Martin Samuel. How good is he? Best sports writer in the business.
So I'm told,
and, yeah, well, I started to read our sports pages, and that's a first, and appreciate the writing and learn from it, you know, because I thought, I've got a lot to learn if I'm going to talk and write about football. So it was very funny, because I never thought I'd have a piece in the Daily Mail which was about football. But of course, it's about more than that, isn't it? It's about a sense of belonging. It's that's what people love, to feel a sense of belonging. It brings us together. It's unifying. It's levelling. You know, you've got, you know, cabinet ministers, brilliant, brilliant cabinet ministers. Well, they're not all brilliant, but you know what I mean, who love football. And then you've got, you know, your average Joe loves football, and your average Joanna too, because so many women are into the sport. And I just feel that at last I've joined them. It's great.
Yeah.
It's a good feeling.
And you make the point, the university lecturer and the labourer both want the same things. They want to see England put that ball in the back of the net.
Yes, and we have a lot of division these days. And people are arguing about everything, you know, all the time on social media. And sometimes it's very unpleasant. But actually, I had a little argument this morning with someone on Facebook. Some guy said, I want them to lose because I hate taking the knee. Well, to tell you this, I don't like the taking the knee stick.
No,
I don't like it. I think it's totally unnecessary and out of place, and it's for the wrong reasons. Well, they don't think it is. They think it's about anti-racism. But, you know, when I was young, there was the anti-Nazi League. There was anti-racism in sport. There's nothing new about it, and I wish they wouldn't do it. But that's not a reason to wish your team would lose. And I hate that sort of nastiness. It's, look at the big picture. Look at the pride in the flag, the pride in the team, the way they support each other. As I say in my piece, that shows us how we should live, supporting each other, you know, pulling together to make this country great.
Absolutely. I agree. And in your, I cheered at your last line, Belle. Let's cheer for the Queen, country and the flag of St. George.
Queen, country and the flag of St. George, Andrew. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I'll have it. I'll have a tattoo done. Actually, I better not say that in public, could I? Because you might make me do it.
We will. And we'll get you to write about it. And then we'll get you to talk about it on the podcast. So best of luck. Enjoy the match, Belle. And let's hope it doesn't go to penalties, because I don't think any of us can stand the tension.
No, I can't stand penalties. So let's just hope.
It's the big day. It's the moment of truth. Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood's here. Oh, my God. Are you nervous? England versus Denmark?
I've hardly slept. Nervous. I just think it's going to be a tough game. I think it's going to be attritional and a difficult game for them to win. I just think this Denmark are a step up in class from the Ukraine, who we beat so comfortably at the weekend. I think it's going to be tough. I think it's going to be, you know, a difficult game. You look at their the two teams on paper, you'd say England got the better players.
Right.
We're at home.
Yeah, big
packed
advantage.
Packed Wembley. Yeah. So that's got to be a big advantage.
Yeah.
So, you know, you would say that on paper we should win it, but I think it's just going to be so tight and it could come down to one moment of magic, one moment of skill, or one mistake which could decide it. And hopefully it doesn't come down to penalty kicks like last night's game.
Oh, no, I don't think the nation can stand that.
When we lost
in the semi-final last time, 20 years ago, was that on penalties?
When we lost Euro 96 semi-final, yes.
So Southgate missed
the crucial penalty, yes. So we don't want to repeat that.
No. So will they have been coached in penalties, Matt?
Yeah, there are very different attitudes to penalties today than they had 20 years ago. So Southgate stood up. He'd never really practiced a penalty before. Don't think he'd even taken one in a competitive game, but he felt someone should stand up and put their hand up and take it. So they hadn't done any training for it. He hadn't sort of practiced it, hadn't done the routine, wasn't familiar with it.
Oh, God.
And therefore he stepped into this whole sort of, you know, new world of the pressure and the walk towards the penalty spot. Nowadays, they've been practicing it they practice it every time they meet up. So even if it's a friendly, in November with no chance of it going to penalties, they still have these penalty sessions. They've drilled down into it about what their technique should be, where they're going to put it. All the way down to the sort of nth degree of focusing on a certain part of the ball that they're going to kick, etc., so that it's become, hopefully, something that they're comfortable in doing, and it doesn't feel.
Who did Denmark beat in the last round?
So in the last round, Denmark beat the Czech Republic on Saturday, just before us. So they beat them 2-1. Okay. Look, they're a good side, and obviously we know about the Christian Eriksen saga.
Which has fired them up somewhat, hasn't it?
Which has fired them up, of course.
Had that cardiac arrest on the pitch.
Yeah. And they're a good side. You know, they've got players in their team who play for the likes of Chelsea. You know, it's not like, you know, none of their players, they're all playing in the third division in Denmark. They play for some of the biggest clubs in the world. So, you know, they've got Tottenham players, they've got Chelsea players, they've got Milan players. They've got players who, you know, the Kiev is the Milan centre-half. So they've got players who play on the biggest stage. So they're not going to come here and be overawed by the occasion by any stretch.
I guess it helps the team as well, though, that Southgate has been through this firestorm of tension and nerves, and when he talks about it, he knows what it's like.
Yeah, I think that massively helps.
Yeah.
And I think it massively helps that he is who he is, and he's so calm.
He's really becoming Mr. UK 2021, isn't he? He's so popular.
He's
respected.
He's incredibly popular, incredibly well respected. He's brilliant with the media.
Yeah.
When he gives answers, he gives proper, thoughtful, intelligent answers. Yeah. And I can only imagine he's like that with the players. The players all seem to love him. He seems to make it very much about the collective and not just about the 11 who start any particular game. So he always makes a point of talking in press conferences about some of the players on the bench, because I think he wants to make them feel part of the whole squad and that they're important. So, for example, the other day he mentioned Connor Cody, who hasn't kicked a ball during this tournament, but Southgate mentioned how Connor Cody celebrated the Jordan Henderson goal. So he was one of the lead people celebrating it. And he said that was brilliant to see, because it meant that the it was about the collective and not just about the players who were on the pitch. So he's brilliant with the other squad players. I noticed as soon as the final whistle went on Saturday and England had won, Jack Grealish, who didn't get on the pitch again but who had been a key player in the Germany game, Southgate went up to him, arm around him, had a long chat with him. Now, I don't know what he was saying, but, you know, if Grealish was feeling disappointed at not having played or got on the pitch at all, well, Southgate was straight there thinking of others. And when England score a goal, he's not wildly celebrating. He's immediately talking to his assistant, Steve Holland, who I think is a key man as well, about what they do next. So he's been a brilliant manager. He's the sort of best manager we've had, you know, for a long, long time, probably since Venables, if not before. So he's a key person and yeah, brilliant man.
You know what I'm going to do to you now, Matt? It's terrible, but I have to ask you, you've got to make a prediction.
I think England are going to nick it. I think it's going to be tight. Yeah. I think it's going to be nerve-wracking, but I think England will nick it 2-1 or 1-0, but we haven't conceded a goal yet, so I'm going to go for 1-0. England to win it 1-0.
And no penalties, thank God.
I can't predict.
The country can't. No. If we go to penalties, I'm locking myself in the loo.
Yeah, I don't think my ticker will handle it either.
No, so. just too stressful. That's the Deputy Sports Editor, Matt Gatwood, who, whether we win or lose, will be back talking about what happened tomorrow. Gazumping, it's back. Home buyers are once again being outbid by rival buyers, even if an offer has been accepted. Dear old estate agents, don't you love them? Here to discuss the return of gazumping and why the home buying industry is now calling on the government to outlaw it is Money Mail reporter Amelia Murray. Amelia, it makes me feel old because this was all around in the 1980s when I first got on the property ladder, and it was appalling.
I mean, don't feel old. You don't look a day over 24.
Oh, you say the nicest things.
What we found, I've spoken to a number of people in the industry, and all they've been telling me is like, it's never been worse. It's not a new problem, but it's never been worse. We have seen, you know, someone was telling me that we've got people wandering by on the day of exchange, seeing people move out or throwing stuff out of a house that's about to be sold, and offering 15 grand extra above the asking price, only for the vendors to then accept it the day before exchange.
Amazing.
We've really seen that, you know, the property market's gone crazy. It's really heated up. There was a figure I got from an estate agent which said that 37% of properties last month that were being sold had three or more offers. And this is like a record high at the moment.
Really?
And so just to explain, you know, gazumping is where you put in your offer for a property, your dream home.
Yeah.
It's accepted, usually in writing, over email or whatever.
Yeah.
And just before exchange, which is when, you know, it becomes legally binding, someone swoops in to offer more. And then that becomes the offer that is accepted.
Do you think the estate agents, they wring their hands in despair, say, what can they do about it? But do you think they secretly encourage it? Because, of course, if the price goes up, their commission goes higher.
So I've spoken to a number of estate agents who do kind of defend themselves here. They are kind of obliged to tell the seller if they do get offers. No one's going to kind of admit to pushing up prices. But I have heard horror stories where, you know, people have received calls from estate agents being like, you know, we've had these bids. Would you like to put in more? Only to be told, you know, well, if you're not going to, then we can't accept your offer anymore. And I think what's really frustrating is, you know, it's not just the emotional investment. If you found your dream home, it's costly as well. If you're kind of ramping up for this purchase, people are instructing conveyances, they're getting their mortgage sorted. We're talking hundreds to thousands of pounds wasted if the property sale falls through. And, you know, so I've had some heartbreaking stories. People who were like, you know, after a divorce or, you know, a death of a family member, are really ready to move on and to start a new phase of their life. Families who are, you know, they've got little kids, they're trying to move to closer schools and families, only to then be gazumped and have their sort of dream hijacked.
Yeah, it's just not fair. Of course, if we were in Scotland, Amelia, it would be much more difficult because, as I understand it, reading your piece, the moment a written offer is accepted, that's it. It's binding.
So there is that. There's also this quite interesting kind of thing in Scotland where lots of estate agents are also solicitors.
Right.
And the Law Society views gazumping as a disciplinary offence. Oh. So if an estate agent was also a solicitor, because they're kind of bound by, you know, the code of conduct of the Law Society, they actually would not be able to work with a seller if they were accepting a higher offer once this kind of agreement has been made, because, you know, they'll be in trouble.
So they could do that quite simply in England.
I mean, on you know, there are sort of other factors.
Right.
I've spoken to people in the legal industry and they're like, to be honest, like to change the law, it's going to be really complicated. However, the government has been talking about trialling these reservation agreements for years. I think they started talking about it back in 2019. And this is not the same as changing the law. This is basically kind of putting in place a commitment at the point of, you know, the kind of the transaction being, you know, the offer being made, and potential penalties either side if the buyer or seller was to pull out. Mm. Of course, there needs to be a discussion about legitimate reasons why someone can't go through with a purchase, rather than just, oh, we got a higher offer. But there's been some interesting comments on the article, and also people who've been in touch with me from both sides, actually. Mm. And one of the, you know, someone wrote in and they were like, you know, I sold my property. I got two higher offers after I accepted the first offer, and I thought, I'm not going to take them because I wouldn't want it to happen to me.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah. So there are kind of ethical sellers out there. Yeah. But then, yeah, I don't know. It's because it's not illegal, so people can get away with it. Yeah. There's no repercussion. Yeah. It leaves a sour taste in everyone's mouth, but there's no comeback.
Will it calm down now the stamp duty holidays come to an end? Because the government, obviously because of COVID, were worried that the housing market would collapse. We see that construction is at a record level, or best level for 24 years or something, I read in the paper. But now the stamp duty holiday's over, might the market calm down and the heat will dissipate?
We have been kind of hearing about this cooling off now the deadline has passed. I guess we're going to have to wait and see, because, you know, as we discussed earlier, like, gazumping is not a new thing, and that is nothing to outlaw at the moment. So there is the potential, but I guess, you know, the supply and demand hopefully will balance out now the stamp duty deadline has passed. Well, I hope it will cool.
Yeah, I hope anyone who's listening to this who's thinking of gazumping thinks again, because as you say, you wouldn't want it to happen to you, would you? But it did happen to me in the 80s a couple of times when I was trying to buy a place. So infuriating. I'd paid for the survey and all the lawyer's fees, and I wasn't earning very much money, and it was so frustrating.
Did you recover?
I got over it. I got over it. But it made me absolutely clear, if ever I was in a position where I've got a higher offer for my property, I would stick with the first one I'd got.
Yeah, be fair.
Yeah, absolutely. Very good. Great piece by Amelia Murray, as ever, in the Money Mail today. Thanks for joining us. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.